A veritable hotel built half a click underground, started around the end of World War II and completed around the same time the Korean War concluded. It possessed everything a surviving populace needed and was accessible to parliamentary members, their families, close friends, logistics and communication staff, and medical and scientific research teams. Not forgetting, of course, a formidable military presence consisting of both regular and ultra-special forces. JTF-2, or Joint Task Force 2, was the Canadian counterterrorism branch of the armed forces, arguably on par with the world's best. JTF-2 had run covert operations alone, or in support of or in collaboration with U.S. Delta Force or England's SAS. Civilians had never heard of their missions. Shovel didn't know much about the secretive branch. Government officials were quite guarded about the activities of JTF-2, whose official motto was facta non verba, deeds, not words. Thank the Lord for the ramblings of one trooper on his way out, who was more than compliant when asked questions about where he'd come from and if there were more. Whitecap. Food, water, geothermal electricity, medical professionals, soldiers, and most important of all, munitions. All there. Enough to supply an army, or hold one off if necessary. Since the bunker was supposed to house the government through times of extreme crisis for years if necessary, the storage capacity of the installation equaled the living and work areas of Whitecap. The entire complex sounded like an apocalyptic Shangri-La, a remote, well-protected oasis in the middle of nowhere, everything anyone could ask for in these dark days. Shovel had gone there looking to barter with the Prime Minister, or whoever was in charge in that hole. He'd been prepared to fight. What he found was rubble. Something had happened to Whitecap, for the tunnel mouth leading, presumably, to the bunker's entrance had been collapsed by explosive measures. For whatever reason, someone had destroyed the tunnel access, bringing the roof down as tons of rock and debris fell and sealing the bunker, rendering it a pain in the ass for Shovel. But not impossible to access. His people had brought up a backhoe from the nearest town and moved the camper and RV units that had been parked in a wide ring around the base of the mountain, where the landscape had been leveled and paved in an area of about 4 football fields, all surrounded by deep ditches, razor wire, and heavy-duty chain-link fences. The place even had an empty helicopter pad and an accompanying hangar. The motorhomes and trailers lent the area a shantytown look of sorts, but Shovel didn't give a shit about looks. It was livable until they could dig through the garbage blocking the way into the bunker. Miners. He'd give a shaven testicle for a couple of people who knew what they were doing. Skilled tradespeople were in short supply. Training a few heads to operate the backhoe wasn't a problem, as Shovel's own background lay in heavy equipment. But clearing a collapsed tunnel made him and everyone working inside the mountain quite nervous. He knew enough about digging to know he needed professionals. Trouble was, he didn't have professionals. He had programmers, bank tellers, legal secretaries, janitors, lawyers, soda pop truck drivers, convenience store clerks, gas pumpers, car salespeople, and line assemblers. Even a woman who actually worked on and conceived new artificial flavors. That was the gene pool Shovel had to work with. Factory workers, paper pushers, and chemical freaks. Wingnuts and dingbats. Lugnuts and assholes. For 3 shifts a day around the clock, they were all put to work after joining up, with the more solid ones being granted tenure within Shovel's clan and the privilege of becoming an armed soldier. Shovel gazed out at the mountain base, taking in the dark maw that had already been cleared. It reminded him of a mouth with its teeth kicked in. A good 210 meters all told, it was a straight tunnel just a little bit wider than the backhoe itself. They had found the intact cement wall on the east side and kept to it as a guide, but Shovel worried. If an entrance might be on the west side somewhere, it was entirely plausible that they might dig right by it. Miners. He needed miners. Or even a geologist with a rudimentary understanding of the earth-clearing process. Even more equipment, bulldozers or hydraulic roof supports would make life easier. What he had was best intentions. Giovanni, his right-hand man, had even suggested a bunker of this size had to have air ducts or possibly even a back door of some kind, just in case the people inside had to evacuate for whatever reason. Shovel liked that thinking. Trouble was, the bunker was situated underneath a fucking mountain, slam-bang in the middle of goddamn nowhere, with ample vegetation growing up to effectively conceal any such hidden entrances. He actually sent people to search for those alternate entry points, but the ghosts of Whitecap had left a rude surprise for such search parties. Landmines. They weren't just little anti-personnel mudbangers either, but the honest-to-God hammers of destruction, powerful enough to blow the unlucky bastard and anyone else in a 20-foot radius to pieces. Mines had been banned from warfare decades before, but Whitecap had apparently deemed them necessary in holding off the undead and had authorized liberal sprinkling of the devices throughout the grounds beyond the wire fence. Shovel didn't know if the weapons had been broken out of some ancient crate somewhere, or if a line of professionals had sat down and line-assembled homemade improvised explosive devices. In any case, discovery of the weapons cost Shovel 2 search parties. But at least they had a greater sense of security, knowing the mines were out there. A knock at his door broke his spiraling thoughts. "Enter," Shovel called. Giovanni walked in, tight-lipped and nodding at him. Gio was thought of as a company yes-man from way back when they had all been marooned up north on a drill site, when the food finally ran out and tar sand beetles eventually became a treat. When the world slid into ruin, Gio was one of the few who kept his head and maintained order, even when things got hairy among the rig pigs and the inevitable violent purge of the malcontents commenced. Tall, lanky, but with a bush of a beard wired with silver, Giovanni had shed his rig-pig profession and family man history, and evolved into a ruthless enforcer with a preference for regular hammers, if he could spare the bullets. Sick followed Gio inside. If Gio was ruthless, then Sick was goddamn unsettling. He was Shovel's height, give or take a half inch, and as well-built as any of the soldiers. Shovel believed the man still had a face. He faintly remembered having seen it once or twice, 2 years or so before, but Sick rarely took off the black balaclava covering his head. The arresting green eyes staring out from that black slit were as flat and dull as beach rock, eyes that had seen horrific acts, probably performed by Sick's own hands, and had discovered both a talent and a peace therein. Shovel's clan had found the man in Brandon, Manitoba, back when they numbered in the 50s, running and fighting a pack of crystal meth-baked crazies calling themselves the Norse. Sick didn't speak much, if at all, but that wasn't a problem for Shovel. Sick did as he was told, especially when the job necessitated killing. Whenever Shovel gave Sick the order to put someone down, he felt as if he'd unleashed the Grim Reaper. If they scouted out a group of survivors, Sick was the ghost sent in to eye matters up close. A pair of Glocks hung in holsters under his arms, but it was the prominent bowie knife at his waist that demanded attention. Sick had a habit of squeezing the hilt as if it was a rubber tension ball. Shovel suspected it was damn near the only way the man kept his shit under control. The next few people to step inside the trailer were a surprise. In came a woman and a pair of kids, a girl and a boy, wide-eyed and obviously frightened. The lady, gray-haired and stiff-backed, carried herself well despite her guards. Shovel thought she was in the plain but attractive zone. Once inside, she turned her blue eyes upon him and curled an upper lip in contempt. That surprised Shovel even more. A person didn't often hate his guts from the get-go. That usually took a few minutes. "Something interesting, Gio?" Shovel asked as the hulking form of Nolan closed the door and guarded the front step.
"Something all right," Giovanni answered and indicated the three newcomers. "This young lady right here is a doctor."
Shovel allowed the surprise to register on his face. He blinked at his henchman, then at the woman.
"No fucking way."
"Way," Giovanni said simply.
boys you sent over to New Brunswick. Well, they spotted one respectable holdout along the water there, up in Shaler Bay. Too big for them to handle, so they took note and decided to head on down to Nova Scotia. Drove around for a few days, scouting things out as per usual, and came across a few little pockets of civilization. Some were larger than others. One was a farm. Nice little setup. There were a few root cellars filled with potatoes, carrots, bottled jams and the like, all ready for the winter. They even brought back a bottled deer and chickens for roasting.
"Holy shit,"
Shovel hissed, becoming even more interested in the woman and her youngsters. "There were others, but old. Slick Pick put them down and left them in the dirt. Says there was a nurse to go with the good doctor here, but they ended up shooting her on a highway somewhere. Got mouthy or something or other. Guess she figured she was too valuable."
"Stupid,"
Shovel hissed, and centered his attention on the doctor.
"Don't get me wrong. Some of my finest, most capable people are women. There's no sexism in my camp. But there is an intolerance for stupid people."
She didn't answer, and the silence stretched out long enough that both Giovanni and Sick turned their heads in her direction. The boy and the girl didn't notice Giovanni, but they certainly took stock of Sick. Most people did, regardless if they wanted to or not. He had that effect.
"What's your name?"
Shovel asked her, thinking it was best to be nice in the beginning. But she didn't answer. Shovel released his breath in a long, drawn-out sigh and fixed her with a death stare.
"I asked you a goddamn question."
Her thin lips quivered, but she got out.
"Maggie."
The death stare softened.
"That's better. I'm Shovel, and you've met Giovanni and Pick. The boogeyman to your left there is called Sick. You're a doctor. What kind? General practitioner?"
"No."
Shovel eyed her from underneath his bushy eyebrows.
"Emergency," Maggie explained. "I worked emergency, mostly."
"Emergency?"
Shovel tasted the wondrous word, studying her face and the crow's feet about her eyes.
"Well, you'll be a welcomed addition to the camp. We don't have a doctor, you see. Matter of fact, these days we're reading books on home remedies if we have a problem, so you're quite the catch. I don't suppose you can do any dental work."
Maggie frowned with exasperated disdain.
"No, I don't."
"Care to learn?"
"Not really, no."
"Let me try that one again,"
Shovel said, his deep voice rumbling as if he were speaking directly into a microphone.
"You will learn. There's a few folks around here that need the attention of a dentist. If anything, you'll have a better idea of how to administer anesthesia than the rest of us. If we can find some, that is. And if you can't handle the pliers or the pulling, you sure as hell know how to stitch. That extra skill set will only increase your value around here. Might even get you the right to vote one day. Hell, to lessen the load, I'll even give you some support staff. How does that sound?"
Maggie didn't reply right away.
"Your men shot and killed my friends."
Shovel didn't flinch from her suddenly red-eyed gaze.
"You're not over that yet? Then do so. They're gone. You're not. Your kids aren't either, if you get my drift."
With that, he turned his attention to the girl and the boy standing at Maggie's sides, clenching her hands.
"And what are your names?"
They didn't answer.
"Come on now, we're going to be seeing a lot of each other. I'm Shovel, and that's all you need to call me. So who are you?"
Still no answer. He flicked a warning glance at Maggie, who understood the message right away.
"Answer the man," she said, giving their little hands a shake. "Chad. Becky."
Shovel allowed a little smile at the introductions and nodded at the good doctor. He reached out and caressed the cheek of the boy, then the girl. Both earned marks for not flinching at the contact.
"We have other little girls and boys in camp here," Shovel told them. "Even have a place for you guys to play around in. Until you get a little older. Then, well, you'll have to work, like everyone else.
What do you mean by that? Maggie asked him.
Just what I said, he replied squarely, arching a brow. I don't know what you were teaching them on your farm there, but here things are a little different. When they hit 13, they're big enough to pull their own weight and will be expected to. The boy in particular will be useful. Even the girl, if she takes to weapons training.
Maggie's mouth dropped open.
Don't give me that look, Shovel said stoically. This isn't a nursery. This is civilization with all too real dangers. Ain't no police out there to solve our problems, no court of law. There's just the basic law of the land, and I think you know what that is. Anyone who thinks otherwise is just fooling themselves. The dead are gone, or almost anyway, but the living are still around. Some in little groups, some in bigger ones, and some of them, well, they aren't nice at all.
These are just children, Maggie said. You can't expect them to...
Children are the future, Shovel cut her off. I know that just as much as anyone, but there's only a limited number of hands around here. When it comes to harvesting or mending or any little job that the kids can handle, well, they'll do it. They'll work for their supper, and they'll have earned it.
Maggie kept quiet, and Shovel saw suspicion on her face.
No, don't worry about that. No perverts around here. We're not total assholes, and if it happens, Mr. Sick here doles out the punishment. Now then, there's a little shack here in camp, which has been designated as the hospital. Not much, but we try. I'm sure you'll help fill in the blanks of what else we need, and when that happens, I'll assign a few folks to head out to the nearest clinic or hospital and see what's available. But let me be clear about something. We're in the middle of backcountry out here, neighbor to the middle of buttfuck nowhere. This place used to be a secret bunker for the government, which is why we're here. Bunkers are protected. There's a chain-link fence around this area with galvanized steel razor wire on top and at the base. You know why it's called razor wire? Take a wild fucking guess. Even if you had tools to snip through that shit, it's all under tension and designed to lash out when cut, like a neat little butterfly knife. Or a scalpel, since you worked in ER. Now, say if someone did make it through that. Well, then there's the terrain itself to deal with. Landmines dot the surrounding forest like pimples on a freshly shaven ass. If you're lucky enough to bypass that, I'd say a good 3-day hike to whatever shitsville you might stumble upon, populated by, well, nobody, if you're lucky. Even if you drive, you'd have to get by the armed checkpoint in and out of this place, and you aren't going to drive.
Shovel smiled sympathetically.
Who knows what else is out there? I don't. But if the government was willing to put up chain-link fences and razor wire, well, I imagine there's all sorts of unpleasant shit out there. The country's crawling with more than a few fucked-up meth heads and crazies, some with cannibalistic tendencies. But the main reason you won't run, the one I want to stress, is because if you do attempt it, we'll find out. And when we find out, we'll make it a game of finding you. One with a very nasty ending for you and anyone else going along. Fingers, toes, ears. Something will come off. And that's the first warning. Try escaping a second time and... Well... Shovel shrugged nonchalantly. I'll kill you. Slow, if I'm really pissed off. Now, if I haven't scared you yet, I'll leave you with this nugget. Think of the kids.
A visibly shaken Maggie swallowed.
You understand me?
Silence. Shovel smiled wetly.
Don't make me repeat myself.
Understood.
Excellent, he brightened. Then welcome aboard. Get comfortable. As a doctor, you're entitled to your own private room and latrine. We'll get a nice blue porta-potty hauled in behind the hospital, and someone will empty it twice a week. I said hospital, but it's really a clinic. You'll see. Well, I think that's all. Nice meeting you.
He didn't bother offering his hand.
And Becky? Chad?
Their gazes lifted and centered on his face.
Be good,
he warned them with a finger. Feeling he'd made his point, Shovel looked at Sick.
Show the good doctor her new home, and then take the kids over to theirs.
They're not staying with me, Maggie blurted. I'm the only one they have left.
No, they'll stay with the other kids. It's better that way. Security, you see. Making sure you won't try running or something stupid. Don't worry, you'll get to see them.
He shrugged one shoulder.
If you're good.
I won't do anything if they don't stay with me, Maggie said. Shovel regarded her curiously.
Didn't you just hear my little speech?
Maggie didn't answer. He became clearly annoyed until she nodded.
Well, read between the lines, Shovel said, his deep, deep voice enough to rattle the windows.
He hooked his head toward the door, and Sick pulled it open and waited for the three new additions to the army. After considering for a second, Maggie pulled the kids outside while Shovel and Giovanni watched them go. The door closed and the two men were alone.
Thoughts? Shovel asked his henchmen.
Giovanni shrugged and finger-combed his impressive clump of beard.
I think she'll get along. She'll be too worried about them young ones.
I hope so. First fucking doctor we've come across in a dog's age. Hate to have to mutilate a kid to get my point across. I'll do it if I have to, but I'm not a complete bastard.
She won't try nothing. We'll keep an eye on her for the first few months. She'll make friends, then forget her old life. In a year, she'll be one of us.
Shovel walked around his desk and sat down heavily, mulling things over.
Yeah, maybe. Anything else from Pick?
He came across a small place in New Brunswick. Some hard cases running the place. Got folks working the fields and such. Set themselves up. You know the type.
I'm the type, Shovel mused. All right, we'll mount up in a day or two and head that way. Liberate the good people and bring them over to the light. Wouldn't it be something if we came across another doctor?
Or a dentist.
I'm with that, Shovel agreed. How many bad guys?
Maybe a few dozen or so. Pick didn't spend too much time on it. He wanted to bring the doctor over right away. He hadn't come in immediately as he'd killed Maggie's nurse on the trip to make a point. Figured you'd be somewhat pissed.
Shovel stewed on that and shrugged.
Only a nurse. And point was made, I figure.
Yep, point was made.
Giovanni sat down across from Shovel without asking. He was the only man in camp who could get away with that indiscretion.
They went way back to when they were just roughnecks starting out. Not toughnecks, as Shovel never had liked that moniker.
The noise of activity permeated the shell of the trailer, and both men listened to it for a while.
How long do you think before we break through? Giovanni asked, which surprised Shovel.
Usually Gio was the one who had the attitude of it happens when it happens.
Who knows? Could be any day.
We're spread really thin out here.
I know.
With the crews hunting up food and water and the scouts out east, I'm feeling a little exposed.
Good thing we got the big gun.
Good thing is right, Giovanni agreed.
We're running low on gas and diesel. Shovel considered those reports. The fuel powering their thirsty machines was dwindling, and some of the new fuel harvested from derelict vehicles wouldn't actually burn, the additives that preserved octane levels finally showing their limitations.
How long you think we have?
Giovanni shrugged.
Depends. Best case, months. Worst case, weeks. But it's coming. The fuel will be worthless. Maybe if we had the facilities and the know-how, we could do something, but we don't. Just the power demands needed for a functioning plant kills the very notion. Besides that, the exact process is beyond our crew. We never refined or enhanced, only drilled.
We'll be riding horses by this time next year.
If we can find them, Gio commented stoically.
Any animals we find will have to be caught and domesticated all over. Too bad we didn't lasso a few heads from that herd we saw out in Alberta 2 years back.
Too bad.
In any case, the right-hand man continued, bicycles will make do until we can come up with something better. Or find someone with a chemical background in processing and refining hydrocarbons.
We'll be okay, Shovel assured them both. One thing at a time. We could punch through the bunker at any time now. They're in there deep enough. All manner of goodies await. I guarantee it.
You still think there's undead in there?
Course there's undead in there.
Shovel kept his voice soft so as not to offend his friend.
That spook fella didn't know this place had been blown. He didn't know. That means the tunnel was blown for a reason, and with the way everything above ground was still in shape, that reason, or threat, came from within. Someone got infected, and there was an outbreak. Maybe a zombie got in there somehow, or pissed in the water supply, who knows. But someone blew that tunnel, and you can bet your nutsack it was because something dire went down. Over 1,200 personnel here. I figure if there was a firefight, probably 600 or 700 of them got wiped out. Zombies, I mean. That leaves the rest unaccounted for, but I'm not worried. The crews going in have their guards, and they all have orders to run back to the cave mouth and get clear. Anything following will get mowed down by the mini. I'm not worried about any of that.
Shovel let that sink in.
Once that threat's been removed, we'll move on in and see what treasures the vault holds.
I'm hoping it's a good haul, Giovanni said.
I know it'll be a good haul, especially seeing how good those JTF-2 guys were outfitted. If they were any indication, then I figure there's a veritable gold mine of weapons down there, and the ammo to go with it. The only challenge, then, is figuring out how the shit works, and if the place still has the generators going, well, we could be looking at our new home. Wouldn't that be nice? Power, plumbing, showers, running hot water, heat controlled by a touchpad or dial.
Does sound good.
And out here, Shovel reminded him, no one will have an easy time finding us. And if they do, with existing defenses, they won't live to tell.
You're in a good mood, Giovanni observed.
I should be. Today we just got ourselves a fucking ER doc. Not a foot doctor, but an honest-to-God frontline medical professional. Old Maggie is a godsend. I'm even thinking she can train midwives once we get to that point. You said Pick brought in some chickens? I say we have ourselves a barbecue tonight.
Giovanni's expression lightened considerably.
A barbecue sounded like a plan.
Chapter 23. The storage RV contained some of Gus's old gear. He found his gloves with the hard plates fixed about the knuckles, his leather jacket, and his cowboy and steel-toed fireman's boots, even a boot knife, but it wasn't his. There wasn't anything else, and he figured the rest had stayed with the SUV. Collie convinced him to join her for something to eat, easy to do as he was feeling peckish, and they took a few of the IMPs and a little of the bottled deer meat taken from the farm. They dined in the kitchen area of a motorhome. Wallace did not join them. The presence of the deer told Gus that whoever had kidnapped Maggie and the kids had come this way, but he hadn't a clue as to which direction to go. He took his time with his meal, finding the IMP, individual meal packet, to be good and not at all nearing the end of its 5-year shelf life. It was a real surprise to find that Como and his boys had secured several boxes of the Canadian version of MREs. He discovered, much to his delight, each meal packet contained not only the main course, but also side portions of food or juice mixes packed in individual wrapping. Chocolate chip cookies, cheese spread, peanut butter, bread, rice and soup mixes, and even butterscotch pudding. All of these tasted fine when prepared in a functioning kitchenette.
The older versions were only good for 3 years, but these are new and improved, Collie said. Sometimes the forces would buy shitloads of MREs from the Americans, and there'd be jawing about which tasted better.
Which one did? Gus asked.
Big surprise. A good many of them were produced in the States anyway. Don't ask how many or for how long, because I don't know. Anyway, I've tried both, and there's not that big a difference, other than the IMPs seem to have a few more goodies when it comes to the dessert menu. And they all contain about 3,500 calories, enough to keep a soldier going in the field.
Gus ate soup with a few pieces of bottled deer. Collie shoveled in beef curry, and while that smelled tempting, he kept to the simpler fare. A meal of curry in his current shaky condition would turn his asshole into the Pacific Ring of Fire, as much as he hated to think about it. He tried not to look too hard at Collie's dark complexion. She'd shocked him when she'd pulled off the ski mask, and her sympathetic smile at his reaction said it all. He didn't know when, where, or how, but she'd obviously been in a fight. Probably a few fights. Maybe one or two she'd even lost. The tip of her nose was missing, as if someone had actually bitten it off. Skin grafts had made the remaining nub slightly presentable, but tearing one's eyes off that battle scar and the two gaping holes leading to her nasal cavity was difficult. The crow's lines at the corners of her eyes, only partially visible because of her mask, were actually black tattoos of thorny vines. The tat on her right side was inked over a sizable section of burnt flesh there, which didn't reach her cheek but did slink down her neck. Her left ear was missing, and a spider's web of scar tissue covered that side of her head. Her ferocious eyes floated on a gathered tar of fleshy lines. Her top lip was thin, but the bottom one full. Her hair, what little grew, was brown and buzzed short, sprouting out on the scalp and devastated sides.
"Insurgent grabbed my ponytail once, so it was snip-snip," Collie had revealed, the only history she'd disclosed at the time.
Recalling the episode, Gus figured any more explanation would have taken an hour, and she'd already stated she was hungry. Though her attitude suggested otherwise, Collie was a walking horror of battle wounds. And Lord above as his witness, Gus struggled with her appearance, as much as he hated to admit it, despite his own collection of scars.
"I'll clean up," Collie announced in her gruff voice after they'd finished eating and threw the packaging into a nearby waste flap underneath the sink. "Get that rug on your chest shaved. When you're ready, just holler."
She left him sitting at the table. The door slowly swung shut as she went outside. Gus stared after her, wondering but unable to ask how she'd gotten so fucked up, afraid to ask. The food made him weary, so he polished off the last of his butterscotch pudding and went to the bedroom, where he collapsed on a wonderfully soft ocean blue duvet. Sleep took him almost immediately. He woke up at the end of a loud snore, and for a split second thought his arms had been chopped off. Then he felt his beard and almost freaked out, thinking a dead squirrel had been superglued to his chin. He collapsed back on the bed when he realized both thoughts were way off the mark.
"Sweet Christ," Gus muttered and sat up.
His arms had returned to normal. A quick inspection showed the red marks around his wrists had almost faded, and his chest and belly had been cleanly shaved, the knife cut padded with gauze bandages and stuck in place with strips and X's of duct tape.
"The fuck?"
He ran a finger over his bald man breasts, feeling how weirdly smooth the whole shorn area was.
"How the hell did this happen?"
he asked the empty room, getting to his feet, his legs even feeling stronger, and gazing at his white skin. A shot of horror stopped him in his tracks, and he tentatively checked his junk, pulling away the waistband of his jeans and peeking almost fearfully. Nope. All was well south of the leather, which was heartening. At least she hadn't shaven him down there. At least, he hoped she'd done it and not Wallace. The thought of his grinning mug doing the job wasn't calming in the least. Gus noted his shirt and sweater lying on a chair near the foot of the bed. He got dressed and stumbled to the toilet. After finishing his business there, he hauled on his ill-fitting sneakers and stepped outside. The day was overcast.
"Afternoon, sunshine,"
Collie called from the other side of a white F-150 pickup parked within the wagon circle of motorhomes.
Sleep good?
Gus regarded her smiling wreck of a face.
Guess I did, since I didn't feel a thing while being fucking shaved. And what time is it?
Ornery, ain't you? It's nearing 2 p.m. You've been out all morning.
All morning?
Yeah.
How the hell did I sleep all yesterday and last night and get my tits shaved without waking up?
Collie leaned over the lip of the pickup's box and gazed at him pleasantly.
I guess it was the stress that did it from your ordeal. That and not being properly rested. Your body just went into repair mode, but that's just a guess. I'd put more faith in the diphenhydramine I slipped into your soup.
Gus stopped cold and fixed her with a look of disbelief.
You what?
I drugged you.
Oh.
You angry with me?
Wallace shuffled through the doorway of an RV, his helmet visor leveled in Gus's direction.
Angry with her? No, nothing like that, Gus confessed. Just feel weird is all.
That's probably a side effect of the antihistamine.
The what?
Diphenhydramine is an antihistamine.
It does that? Make a person feel weird?
Not really. I just said it to make you feel better, just so you could get over your feelings of being violated. Nice tits, by the way.
A mortified Gus kept his mouth shut.
Don't worry, Collie soothed. It was the best way to clean up those cuts.
For the first time since getting up, Gus felt the patch under his right eye, where Cam Bowl had almost threatened to hook it out.
As for your chest, Collie nodded. Well, couldn't very well shave around it. And once I started, I couldn't exactly stop. That'd look fucked up. And I only did the chest and the belly, nothing else. Left the beard, didn't touch your back. Or your balls.
Well, thanks.
Don't mention it. But if you do need your thingy mode...
I don't need my thingy mode.
But if you do...
Give you a shout?
Collie drew back.
Not me, ask Clay over there, he'll do you up.
Framed in the doorway, Wallace shook his head in derisive doubt at the suggestion.
Yeah, well, Gus said slowly, regaining composure. I think I'll be fine, thanks.
Anytime. Feel better now?
Yeah. What are you guys up to?
Collie gestured to the box on the pickup.
This? Just loading up shit that won't perish in the weather or anything. Scavenging, some would say.
Ah.
Gus had no problem with that.
You come across an SUV?
Wallace did, in fact, find an SUV drawn up on the shoulder of the road over there, on the south side and down a ways. Front's all crunched up, though. And it had a couple bullet holes decorating the windshield. Deployed airbag. That your ride?
Well, yeah, it was.
There were some things scattered around the rig.
Wallace joined in the conversation, his head tilted to one side.
Well, Gus said. Anyway, I think I'll head on down there, get the rest of my shit. Sort of attached to it all.
He made to turn away.
Hey, Gus, Collie called.
Yeah?
You still gonna look for your doctor and those kits?
Gus didn't even think of that as a question.
Yeah, matter of fact. After I check out the SUV, if it's okay with you, I might take one of these motorhomes.
They got shitty mileage.
Only until I can find another ride.
Huh. Well, listen, Wallace and I have been talking. We'll help you find the doctor, if you want.
Gus regarded her battle-scarred features and took his time answering.
Why?
Because she's a doctor.
That all?
No, that's not all, Collie said. Wallace and I... We're reconning the area, the whole province, in fact, knocking off any remaining infected and gathering up anyone still alive. Life carries on, you know. There's a small community, not many people, but it's there, protected. They stay where they are and live their lives while we get to do the dangerous stuff on their behalf. Our mission is threefold. Kill the leftover undead, gather up the living, and harvest any worthwhile supplies, anything that's still good.
Like guns?
Collie smirked.
More like ammunition. We have plenty of guns. Cannons are all over the place. Finding something to load into them, that's a problem. But the real hope is finding people with specific skill sets. Lawyers and politicians we can do without, but doctors, dentists, carpenters, mechanics, and so on, people with functional trades essential to rebuilding what was. There's not a lot of them out there. The virus didn't care who got infected. And if we do find someone, half the time, they've reverted into a dark, dangerous kind of crazy, if you follow me.
I follow, Gus said quietly. Did he ever?
I know the little group we serve and protect doesn't have a doctor, Collie revealed. They'd shit themselves if we had one to bring back.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. A doctor? A qualified, experienced medical professional, and not just Joe anybody trying to figure things out from a textbook? Well, let's just say in this world, she's worth the weight of a whole town in gold.
Whole town in gold. Gus reflected and fidgeted with that knowledge, studying Collie's harsh mug. He even glanced over at Wallace.
I can't speak for her, Gus finally said. All I know is that whoever has her took her and the kids after they murdered everyone else on the farm. You already helped me out, without asking for anything in return, so you help me find them and we can put the question to her then.
Collie spread her hands.
Sounds fair.
Then she regarded Wallace.
You good?
The frightening soldier nodded once, the rictus of a grin tight around his lips.
Okay, Collie announced. We're agreed. Do whatever you have to do then, and let's roll.
Gus wandered away from the pair and went outside of the circle of motorhomes. His path took him across the slope of the overpass, and he stopped and studied the not-so-far-off bastion Como and his freaks constructed up there. The gradual incline was littered by a few wrecked and not-so-wrecked cars, ending in what appeared to be a collection of vehicles parked at the top. A tarp of some sort fluttered just over a red roof, with a white streak rising and falling as a breeze gave it life. The thought occurred to Gus that he hadn't seen the bodies, but he suspected they might be up there, just beyond that white flag of rustling tarp. At that particular moment, his vision tunneled, and he centered on that subtle motion. It wasn't that breezy there, at the foot of the overpass, so what could be moving that piece of whatever the hell it was? The more Gus thought about it, the more puzzled he became. He decided it best to walk up there and check things out. Wallace's sickly face entered his mind, the soldier's haunting grin and diseased gum lines. And he hadn't eaten. At least, the soldier didn't eat when he and Roxanne had sat down to eat.
What was up with that?
Gus rattled his head. He'd meant Collie, who didn't look a thing like the woman out of his violent past. Up on the overpass, the tarp rose and fell, waving, beckoning, wanting him to walk on up there and investigate a mystery easily solved. Everything else around the edges blurred. After a short hike, all would be revealed. Como and company, or their remains. Their animated remains. He took two steps toward the top.
Where are you going, Gus?
Wallace's voice smacked him hard upside his senses, and he jerked around as if poked with a live wire. The man stood between two motorhomes, head cocked to the side, eyes hidden behind his visor, waiting patiently for an answer. Gus's attention flickered from the top of the overpass to the unwell soldier. He sputtered and stretched his back, spinning his mental wheels through lies.
Just look in there.
Wallace casually regarded the overpass, untroubled with the world, it seemed.
You wondering what's up there?
Gus composed himself.
Yeah, I am, actually.
What do you think might be up there?
I think Como and his boys might be up there.
Como and his boys.
Yeah.
The same men who tortured you and left you for a zombie to feed upon? The same good old boys who appeared to rape their victims as well as kill and rob them?
Those are the men who you're wondering about?
Gus had nothing to say to that, so he just screwed up his face and stared, unable to get a read on Wallace.
Well, they're up there, the soldier reported with laid-back casualness. Right where Collie shot and left them. And searched them. But after being left out for a day and change, they aren't the prettiest to look upon. Fair warning. Unless you don't mind looking at decomposing bodies.
Gus had nothing to say to that either.
No, I don't. I mean, I...
Don't let me keep you then, but personally, if I were you, I wouldn't.
With that, Wallace walked away, working legs that might have had cement poured into the joints. Gus watched him disappear around a corner. A motor started nearby. He hesitated a few seconds more, pressing a hand over his duct-taped slash wound before walking off in search of the SUV. Wallace was right about one thing. Como and company deserved whatever they had coming to them. All the same, that fluttering piece of white tarp hung in his mind, drawing his attention with sinister implications. 10 minutes later, Gus located the SUV and inspected its metallic carcass with all the mute reverence an old gunslinger might muster for a reliable horse. They'd shot him off the road, and he'd crashed into the small roadside pond. His hands hung off his hips, staring at the scrunched-in front caked with dried weeds and at the blown-out windshield. Every door lay open, and glass fragments glittered like diamonds on the front seats. Deployed airbags, deflated with a knife perhaps, sagged off the steering wheel and passenger dash. Dirt coated the cookware where it had been tossed out and kicked. Shaking his head at the rape of his ride, he peered into the front and back seats before moving to the rear. The toilet paper was all gone, which didn't surprise him, as was the water and food, even the bag of muffin mix. The long-neck lighters he'd gathered were still there, still functional. The duffel bag was in a dusty heap 5 feet from the rear, which surprised him because it was a duffel bag, so Gus picked it up and shook it out. Frowning, he gathered up everything possible, which wasn't a lot, and tucked it all away in the bag's cloth folds. He found the Nomex gear in a clump of dead grass halfway to the pond. It all went into the duffel. But no bat. Gus scoured the area until he felt time dragging, hoping the weapon might be in one of the RVs. Lugging his gear back, he returned to the encampment. Collie and Wallace hung out in the doorway of a white rig, the one chosen to be a roving pack wagon.
"There he is," she chimed. "Find what you were looking for."
"Some of it," Gus answered and dropped the duffel. "You see a bat around?"
"A bat?"
"Yeah, aluminum one."
"Check out the bar."
"Huh?"
"The bar," Collie repeated. "That's the Winnie over there, you'll see. Saw a bat in a leather scabbard hung over the back of the driver's seat."
Gus turned in the direction pointed.
"That one?"
Collie nodded.
"Are you guys ready to move?"
"Waiting on you, Civvy,"
Wallace answered dryly and with a twinge of impatience. Gus cocked an eyebrow at the reference.
"What he means," Collie stepped in, "is that we probably have less than 3 hours of daylight left, and then we're stuck for the night. Not that it's a big problem now."
"What do you mean?"
Collie smiled.
"We'd usually camp out in someone's house, or even a hotel if we came across one. Never in the open. And there's plenty of comfortable places to stay, if you don't mind the occasional cleanup. Welcome to the apocalypse."
Gus knew what she meant by cleanups.
"How many of these are you taking?" he asked, referring to the motorhomes.
"We've stocked up two. Hooked our pickup to the rear of one. You can ride with me or Ollie, your choice."
Gus had already made his choice.
"I'll ride with you. No offense, Wallace."
Instead of commenting, the soldier inspected the unzipped duffel bag.
"Is that turnout gear?"
Gus looked at the Nomex.
"That's firefighter gear, yeah. Boots and all. What did you call it?"
"Turnout gear. Bunker gear."
"Never heard it called that before," Gus said.
"You never hung out with firefighters,"
Wallace remarked pointedly and went on with his inspection.
Good idea, though. Thick layered material, fire resistant and puncture proof. The older stuff wasn't, but this can stop most things outside of a 9 mil. What's it weigh, 10 kilos?
Gus shrugged uncertainly.
Yeah, I guess about that.
Wallace managed a horrid smile.
Adapt and overcome. Very good, Civvy.
The mellow approval almost made Gus feel good about himself.
Well, thanks. Give me a few minutes, okay?
He walked away. Gus pulled himself aboard the motorhome Collie had called the bar. The place had been rudely remodeled, for in the center of the interior was a poker table with accompanying chairs. Gambling chips of various colors littered the surface. In disbelief, Gus spotted the bat, still in the leather sheath Adam had made for him, hanging off the driver's seat. He took it and slung it over his shoulder and looked around further. His mouth hung open.
Jesus Christ and Mary.
The rear of the motorhome, where the bedroom would be, was full of cases of alcohol. Gus stopped on the threshold, stunned cold in his tracks, and simply stared at the cursed oasis. Open and closed boxes of assorted bottles lay about, all full, some stacked tall and some lining shelves. Colored glass gleamed.
The bar, Gus's inner voice whispered, laying eyes on the unit with three tall stools bolted into the floor.
The bed had been ripped out, and in its place, spiritual goodness.
Holy. Holy, Gus whispered as he inspected the labels. Liqueur, whiskey, rum, vodka, gin, and those were just the visible ones.
There were boxes stacked behind and underneath each other, to the point that if someone was sitting at the bar and fell over backward, his head would crash into a glorious bounty.
And goddammit did the ferocious urge to partake ever come over him. Just for luck, just for the ceremonious gesture of well-wishing.
Shot glasses and beer mugs rested on shelves behind the bar, and a small fridge propped on milk crates contained beverages he didn't even recognize right away. It wasn't like the liquor shops in Annapolis, but it would put a smile on the faces of the desperate and thirsty. He didn't drink anything, however. Instead, he went behind the bar and stared, shocked, once more. Grinning at him was the captain, the same captain stuck on the side of a plastic bottle that had traveled with him up to this point, taken from the SUV wreck and placed among its distilled cousins. Gus studied the captain's smiling features and felt his own face lighting up.
"How you doing, old buddy?"
The sailor did not respond. Gus figured that was a good thing. He still had all his marbles in place. The amber rum sloshed around as he picked it up and tilted the bottle this way and that. Same bottle. Had to be. He wanted it to be. With the stash of alcoholic merriment in the bar, Gus could see why this little flask of rum had been tucked away in the fridge instead of being downed right away. A length of leather twine dangled off the knob of a drawer. Gus pulled it off and ignored the extra poker chips, but a good 3 feet or so of the material hung there, begging to be used. So he used it. Chapter 24.
"Find your friend?" Collie asked when Gus emerged. The smile on Gus's face answered that.
"The bat was where you said it was, which is great."
"Nothing beats a solid bat," Collie agreed. "And one for the road?"
Gus held up the bottle, the captain's face pointing outward.
"This is an old house and road buddy of mine. Same bottle, untouched. Never thought I'd find that there. Forgot about him, to tell the truth."
"He a good luck charm or something?" Collie asked.
Gus regarded the naval officer. He'd taken the twine and tied it around the bottle's base and neck, strapping everything in place with gobs of duct tape found in a utility drawer. Only the captain's head appeared, but now he had a little extra protection with the molded layers of tape. The twine dangled from his hand, and if he wanted, he could slip it over his head as a heavy necklace.
"Big medicine," Gus declared. "It's a good thing."
Wallace looked at Collie and cleared his throat, the sound like a wet phone book being torn in two in front of a bullhorn. Gus hated to imagine what was moving around in the soldier's chest making that noise.
"You didn't take any of the other stuff?" Collie asked.
"What? The booze, you mean?"
"Yeah, the booze."
Gus shook his head.
"Don't need it."
"Well, don't fret any. I loaded up a few boxes. Good trade goods, even if we don't get into it."
"Well, I'm set," Gus said.
"Any idea of which direction to go?" she asked.
"None."
That left Wallace and Collie quiet.
"I've just been following my nose," Gus offered. "But that bottled deer meat, that's from our farm. How these guys got it, well, that's obvious. Someone gave it to them while passing through."
"I asked the question because we're at a crossroads here," Collie pointed out, "where the 102 runs into the 104. Now, we came from the east and haven't seen or heard anything, so by default, we could keep rolling west, see if we cross anything. It's a long shot, really, knowing how many side roads and smaller highways there are spread out over a very, very big piece of territory. But seeing what's at stake, it's still a shot. We got a lot of supplies here, but our folks can wait for a bit, so we don't have to head back there right away. At least, not until we see what's what. See if your nose is on. If you're willing."
"I am," Gus said.
"Let's go then," she said to Wallace. "I'll take the FNG.
"Let's hope they don't turn stateside," the zombie-ish officer rumbled.
"Why's that?" Gus asked, while puzzling over what FNG might mean.
"Because that's where the fallout was the worst," Wallace said. "When the machines stopped being monitored, things started falling apart. The containment measures for radioactive cores at every nuclear plant eventually failed, north and south of the border. Just so happens most of our facilities were built along the border. I'd advise against traveling down there. Anyone in, say, Toronto or thereabouts, who weren't turned into something dead and walking, who actually lived, pretty much died from fallout. Don't even drink the groundwater from anything within 100 clicks of a plant."
"So what do we do?"
"Realistically," Wallace continued in that trance-like voice of his, "we drive on, drive slow, and keep our eyes open for signs of people. Maybe we'll luck out. Personally, I give us a 10-15% chance of finding your pecker checker. That's doctor in your tongue. But like Collie said, she's worth it."
"I don't think she can help you," Gus said after a pause, confronting that dark visor. The skeletal grin underneath widened.
"Civvy," Wallace said. "No one can save me."
A pair of motorhomes, one towing a flatbed trailer with a battered wooden shack built on top, the other dragging a white pickup, moved westward on the 104 Trans-Canada Highway, gradually curving north. Gus sat in the passenger seat while Collie drove, taking the lead as Wallace followed. The usual detritus of vehicles plagued the highway. Some stopped in a mesh of traffic, while others rested on the shoulders at interesting angles. Collie slowed the monster motorhome and threaded through the worst of the tangles, sometimes scraping the sides. At times, she drove across the dip of a median and rumbled the unit up the other side to bypass knots of stranded vehicles.
"Should have expected this," she muttered, checking for available mirrors.
"The highway?" Gus asked.
"Yeah. We got a fat ass, made worse by hauling along that generator."
Gus didn't ask why they'd brought it along. A working generator meant power and creature comforts. For a while, anyway.
"Whereabouts you from?" he asked her.
"Originally Odessa, just outside of Kingston, Ontario. You?"
"Annapolis."
"Never been.
Yet." "I've never been to Odessa."
"Well, you never know. Way the world is now, you can travel as much as you want until the gas runs out. Then it's waiting for someone to figure out how to power up and operate an oil refinery.
Not me, Gus smiled. I'll stick to taking the leftovers out of gas tanks.
How do you do that?
Drain them with a spike and hammer. I have a pan to catch the gas.
That's nasty.
Collie spared him a quick glance.
Ever have one catch fire on you?
Not yet. Usually plastic tanks. Don't worry. I know what I'm doing.
I suppose so.
How do you guys get gas out of the tank? Gus asked.
Siphon it in the new-fashioned way, with a little rig called a snake. It fools the security locks on the tanks, makes the sensors think the car's about to be refueled, and before you know it, it's draining every drop. All done with a self-charging hand crank as well.
That a military thing? Gus asked, impressed.
No, that's a little invention of a professional gas thief back at the community.
She glanced at him again.
You meet all kinds.
That made Gus chuckle, and he focused on the road for a bit before asking what Collie probably expected.
What's up with Wallace?
Collie slowed the motorhome down to thread its mass through an alley of transport trucks.
Short answer, he's sick.
He's not a gimp.
A what?
A gimp. That's what I call him, or deadheads.
Huh, that's different. We call them Mo.
Mo?
Yeah, some folks traveling from back east called them that. Name stuck. Shorter than MBs, which we used to use.
MBs?
Meatbags.
Meatbags? Gus liked that one himself. Well, how about Wallace, then? Or is that a taboo subject around here?
Not taboo, Collie said. But maybe classified is a better word. We think you're okay. Not a crazy, I mean. But we have our secrets, understand, which is why it was better for you to ride with me for now, just to explain this very topic.
Okay, I'm listening.
Let us warm up to you a bit, get to know you, and maybe, in the end, Wallace will tell you himself.
In the end?
Collie regarded him with a hint of a secretive smile, her eyes like eerie sapphires. Gus indicated his newfound pistols.
What about these, then?
You can keep those.
Gus whistled softly.
You guys are some cool customers.
Honey, you don't know the half of it.
All right, I can wait. I'm just glad someone knows what's going on with Wallace.
Well, I should know.
Collie concentrated on her driving.
I married the guy.
The low-hanging clouds darkened, pressing down on spirits as well as daylight, and at the 4:27 mark of the winter evening, the lead motorhome rolled to a stop below an east-west overpass. The headlights flared ahead, but they weren't really needed to see what lay on the highway ahead. A serpentine parade of vehicles stretched the length of the road, twisting and gleaming in the fading light. Knots of metal piled up in places, where cars or trucks had seemingly rammed into each other, perhaps wasted attempts to push forward, perhaps frustration or fear finally taking over the drivers. Collie steered the big machine up the ramp, turned left, and slowed to a stop just past the middle of the overpass. Cars blocked the way ahead, preventing any further progress.
"And that's that," Collie whispered, placing the RV in park.
She sighed and looked around, appraising the roads and thinking.
"Done for the day?" Gus asked.
"Yeah, I think so. We'll camp out up here, just like a tree."
Gus stared at the highways, the gloom of the encroaching evening both depressing and hypnotizing. Any moment he expected to see figures stand up from between the vehicular segments like sinister prairie dogs lifting their heads to the wind. Nothing did, however, and he had to remind himself gimps didn't walk much these days. They crawled, searching for ankles.
"Well, might as well lock ourselves down and get comfortable," Collie said and got up from her seat, her combat gear rattling.
Gus turned around in his seat and stood a few seconds later as the side door clicked open and a gust of cold air came in. He stepped outside and looked around, spotting Wallace's ride coming to a rest with a soft squeal of brakes. Kali stood at the guardrail of the overpass, studying the terrain. Gus wandered over, adjusting to a temperature much cooler than the interior of the motorhome.
See anything?
In this? Kali asked. It's almost dark out, bro. Can't see anything right now. But if you listen...
Bro.
Gus thought of Talbert and his death grip, the moment freezing and rewinding in his head. Kali looked to the north and shook her head at the cars and trucks obstructing the road. She then gestured west, where the highway sloped down the overpass. A collection of houses, large and small, could barely be seen at the end of a long but congested stretch of highway running underneath them. A zap of lightning would complete the scene. Wallace opened his door and stepped out with glacial grace. Just hearing him move sounded painful, and Gus had to look to see if the man was doing okay. The soldier was working his strut, taking it slow and easy. He had his visor lifted.
Look at that, Collie said, distracting Gus.
She nodded toward the distant little town, black and somber looking.
You know something? When the world was teeming with people, I used to hate it. Fucking despised it. The attitudes, the fakes, the burnouts, the authority, the crazies. And at the time, the sheep mentality of it all. The 9-to-5 insanity. The chase. Now, God, I miss it. Miss every engine rev, every hello from across the street, every dickhead texting on a smartphone, and every fucking cornflake. I miss it. Talk about not knowing what you got until it's gone, eh?
Gus didn't have to be a psychic to feel her angst, so he stayed quiet, not knowing Kali well enough to comment. However, despite her physical appearance, her disfigured face and scars, he was beginning to like her.
See anything? That Zen voice asked from behind.
Wallace, however, Gus was still undecided about.
Not much, Kali said, and thumbed in the direction of the blocked road to the north. Not about to go through that. Maybe in the morning we can back up and get onto another lane, go around it. One thing's for sure, if we can't get through, Gus's kidnappers didn't either.
Probably, Wallace said.
Gus turned to see the man's visor lifted, revealing a tightly drawn mask of unsettling flesh and dark veins. The sight robbed him of his voice. Wallace fixed him with an unfiltered look of annoyed curiosity.
See anything interesting, Civvy?
That dislodged Gus from his gawking and he turned away, starting to dislike the nickname. He wondered if Wallace had forgotten his real name. He decided to remind him.
Name's Gus,